Hello, everybody, and welcome to 48 Minutes from the Believe Network. I'll be running the point tonight as our colleague Ross Geiger is taking a well-deserved week off. I'm Bruce Bernstein, the former coordinating producer for NBA studio shows at ESPN, where I picked up four Emmy Awards and spent more than three decades producing shows and soaking up knowledge from the best analysts in the business. And I'm joined by two-time Emmy Award winner, Michael World B. Freer. World B is the senior writer for Stat Factor. He's our numbers guru, and he prepares advanced statistical information for many broadcast teams around the NBA. Before we dive in this post-Eastern Conference Finals emergency pod, our show is presented by BetOnline, your number one source for the NBA and NHL playoffs this season. Every stat, every matchup, and even live odds while the games are being played. When the game's over, head on over to our online casino and get in on a game of blackjack or poker, or you can unwind with one of our more than 150 slots games. Head to the website today to get in on the action. Don't forget to use promo code BELIEVE, that's B-L-E-A-V, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, the game is here. World B, let me just say hello to you before I go into the straight introduction. How you doing on this late night Monday, early Tuesday morning pod?
I'm doing very well. Had another exciting game that we're going to get into. We've had an exciting conference finals, both of them, despite the series record being what they are. But everything is good.
Great. Well, this is show number 106 in honor of Celtics legend Bill Russell, who wore the uniform number 6, which has since been retired by the NBA. And only one player still wears number 6, and that's Alex Caruso of the Bulls, of all people. He was grandfathered in since he had the number as a member of the Bulls before the league retired it. But it is somewhat ironic that tonight's show honors a Celtics center because the basketball world lost another Hall of Fame center on Monday who played with the Celtics. Of course, we're talking about Bill Walton, who was a great admirer of Bill Russell. Bill lost his battle with cancer at the age of 71. But Bill was so much more than a great player. He was a great human being. I could go on and on about our friendship, which included many years working together at ESPN and many personal stories with Bill, his amazing wife, Lori, and my own family. And with Bill's passing, the world lost a great man whose mission in life was to spread goodness and positivity. And he succeeded beyond his wildest belief. So rest easy, my friend. Bill, you will never be forgotten. World B, you must have some memories of Bill Walton. You followed his career.
Oh, absolutely. Probably the most gifted big man who's ever played the sport, which is not hyperbole when you look at how he played and the numbers he accumulated. You know, he only played the equivalent of less than six NBA seasons because of injuries. The rest of the world really didn't get to see how great he was. But in those, you know, basically in less than 500 games, he won two NBA titles, won an league MVP, won a finals MVP, sixth man of the year. And his accomplishments at UCLA are legendary as well. He's a Hall of Famer in college and up in Springfield. So he's got a list of accolades. He was a winner. I just told you this before we came on. I looking up his stuff. He went from his junior season in high school, which would have been 1968-69, to his senior season at UCLA through his senior season and lost six games, 168-6 record combined over there. And he went 5 years from his senior year in high school through middle of his senior year at UCLA. 5 years where he did not lose a game. That's unbelievable. That's absolutely the personification of a winner. And that's what, along with his free-loving lifestyle, I guess, is the best way to put it. His accomplishments on the court will never be forgotten.
Yeah, I mean, when he was, you know, coming up through UCLA, the thing about him that always sort of set him apart was that he was an unbelievably good passer. You know, we admire Nikola Jokic in today's NBA because of his ability to pass. And I would say that probably, you know, the three or four best passing bigs that I can recall, calling bigs like 6'11 and above, were probably Bill, probably Arvydas Sabonis, who was a contemporary of Bill, who played mostly in Europe and also had his career cut short by injury. And of course, Domantas Sabonis, who's Arvydas Sabonis' son, is currently with the Sacramento Kings. And of course, Nikola Jokic. So when you had a big man who could see over the defense, who could just pick defenses apart, he made every teammate around him better, World.
Absolutely. You hit it right on the head about his ability to pass. You listen to people of his era talk and opposing coaches where nobody grabbed a rebound and started a fast break better than Bill Walton. UCLA was legendary for their fast break offense, and Bill was a major part of that when he was there. He did things playing the game that, like I said before at the top, probably the most skilled big man that of this the sport has ever seen. That's just, you know, just how it is.
And he could shoot a little bit too. I remember he used to make a lot of outside shots using the glass. That's totally become a lost art. Nobody shoots it off glass pretty much since Tim Duncan retired, as far as, you know, bigs. And the thing that I'll remember most about Bill, I mean, I worked with him at ESPN for a number of years, but also had an opportunity to become good friends with Bill. It's funny, I was in Nashville, Tennessee a couple of weeks ago visiting with a former colleague, Adam Stanko, who runs 24/7 sports down there. And he was asking me, it's funny that Bill's name came up. He was asking me, what's your best memory about Bill? And one day Bill Walton and I were having lunch in West Hartford, Connecticut, which is the town we were both living in at the time. And after lunch, we took a little walk down the street. So we're walking down LaSalle Road in West Hartford after having lunch at our favorite restaurant, which was called Brico, which is still there. And I hear this muffled sound from way down the road. It was like, boo, boo. So I turned around and I looked back down the road, and it was Manute Bol, who was living in West Hartford, 7'6" Manute Bol. So I said, Bill, Manute Bol is down the street there and he's calling your name. He's there. Whoa, let's go say hello to Manute. So we walk up to Manute. We met him about halfway. Manute had been in a terrible car crash not long before that, and walked with a cane. Now, the cane was like up to my shoulders, and I'm 6 feet tall, you know. So his cane was up here. And so here's Bill, and here's Manute, and I'm standing between them. I wish I'd had a camera phone at the time. That would have been a great picture. Bill says to Manute, Manute, how did you know it was me? And Manute goes, I could tell by the way you were walking from like 300 yards down the road.
Right.
But anyway, so that's probably my most memorable Bill Walton story. Any other personal thoughts or just observations about Bill from you, World, before we move on to Monday night's big game four of the Eastern Finals?
Just a unique individual. There has never been anyone like Bill Walton, and his passion for life as well as passion for basketball are unmatched, really.
Well, I'm sure the Celtic Nation, you know, we're all shedding a little tear for him tonight, but we're also very happy because on Monday evening, the Celtics took care of the Indiana Pacers in game four, swept them out 105-102 in a game that, once again, Indiana was in it right up until the end. But I think it seemed as if their lack of experience in big moments, then, you know, facing a team that had been in a lot of these big moments, it seemed that they, as usual, they played like a good 47-minute game, and that last minute pretty much killed them, World B.
Absolutely. The way they performed in what they call the clutch minutes, which is when the game has a margin of 5 points or less with 5 minutes to go in the game or overtime, you know, that period. In those clutch moments, Boston came through, as you would expect a veteran group to do, and Indiana just did not have enough to get by. And, you know, it's funny, Boston in this playoffs are 4-0 in games where there are clutch minutes, and three of those four games happened in this series. They won them all the tight ones they won, so that's why it looks like a 4-0 sweep, and that's how it's going to be recorded. It certainly didn't feel that way for much of the series.
You know, I know, you know, Boston gets a lot of sort of, I don't want to say hate, but a lot of people love to nitpick at them. They say, oh, they're a super team. How can they, you know, have these tight games or or like blow some of the games they blew in the first couple rounds, one against Miami, one against Cleveland. But here's the thing. All that really matters is that they won the games, okay? And they're doing it every way you need to do it. I mean, you know, they have the two stars who have really, you know, I mean, does anybody want to talk about breaking them up now? I mean, for a while it was like, gee, can these guys play together? Well, it looks to me like they've formed almost an ideal partnership, you know, kind of at the top of the pyramid there. And then, you know, they have the other guys that are playing unbelievable for them. But I was really, really happy to see Jaylen Brown win the Larry Bird Trophy for the MVP of this series, because I thought, starting with game one, Tatum had great games, but I thought Jaylen Brown was consistent at both ends of the court, made, you know, forceful moves to the basket, made threes, grinded it out on defense. And, you know, tonight or Monday night, he had the assist on the game-winning hoop where he, like, whipped the ball to Derek White in the corner to untie the game. That was it. So I'm really happy. Jaylen Brown gets a lot of grief, the Celtics as well. But I was super happy to see him pick up that award. It was well-deserved.
Yeah, I don't think he went wrong. There were two standouts in this series from Boston's end. It was Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. I don't think there is any question. Jaylen Brown played an absolutely fantastic series. He had a great game in game four Monday. So, yeah, well-deserved. And, yeah, the thing about Boston is when you have those expectations – which they had at the start of the season because of the lineup they put out there. There is very little margin for error in the eyes of fans or anybody. You know, nobody has a whole lot of respect for Joe Mazzulla as a coach. They didn't last season. They wind him gone after last season. He went to the conference finals when he kind of righted a ship that was really in disarray after the late coaching change, all that mess that went on there. But he got them to the conference finals. He didn't get credit for that. He gets them now to the NBA Finals. And every time they lose, though, it's a referendum on his coaching somehow. It's a referendum. What's wrong? You know, they've lost two games in the postseason. What's wrong with the Celtics? After every loss, what's wrong with the Celtics? Well, nothing's wrong with them. They're going to the NBA Finals and will be, I would imagine, prohibitive favorites against whichever team they face. It's when you have that bullseye on you, as they had all season, and you dominate. By the way, they dominated the league this season. We've talked about it over and over. The most efficient offense in the history of the league. And they had that. They shoot threes like it's going out of style. That was the game plan coming in this season. You could see it develop in the offseason when they acquired Kristaps Porzingis. And then they get Drew Holiday. This was a team that already liked to shoot the three-pointer. Now they were going all in on it, and they wanted better shooters for that style. And it worked. It worked to the tune of a dominating the best team in the league overall this year. Nothing less than a championship is going to be satisfactory for them. And that comes with the expectations. That comes with the job, especially when you're in a sports-crazed town like Boston.
You know, they went 64-16 during the regular season, and now they're 64-18, sorry, in the regular season. And now they're 12-2 in the playoffs. So their record regular season and playoffs right now is 76-20. Okay. If that's something that is sort of deserving of criticism, then I'm like, you know, fine, have at it. I mean, but they've never lost three games in a row at any point during the season. You know, that's pretty remarkable. And look, it's not like they've played this entire playoffs at full strength either. I mean, you know, they lost Kristaps Porzingis in the first round. He didn't play at all against Cleveland. That was a five-game series. He didn't play at all against Indiana. That was a four-game series. So when everyone says, well, you know, Boston should roll over these guys, you know, everyone's injured on every team they played. Well, everyone's injured on their team as well. Not everyone, but people are injured on their team as well. And as far as having like the easier path, I mean, look, the reason that you try to get the best record in your conference is so that you can get the easier path to reach the finals. That's how it's always worked. So for anybody to kind of, you know, use that as a nitpick against Boston, I think is a little bit kind of silly. I mean, it's never been otherwise.
It's not just an easy path as you have the best record. It's playing the Miami Heat without Jimmy Butler. It's playing the Cleveland Cavaliers without their best player for the final two games in Donovan Mitchell. And it's playing the Indiana Pacers with the last two games without Tyrese Halliburton. Those are legitimate claims. I don't necessarily think it's the easy. First of all, who cares? They were saying this thing about Denver last year. When the book is finally written, it's going to write champions. I don't care how it ends up. The fact is, though, their path was made easier by the absence of these critical players on these other teams. That's just how it is. But nobody cares at the end. Your job is to win. Nobody's singing the blues for the Knicks here. Oh, if the Knicks hadn't been healthy, or if the Knicks hadn't gotten so hurt, what could have? That's the way it goes. That's sports. That's the way things are. So yeah. The problem when you're especially in this day and age, when you're a team like the Celtics and you dominate like you do, every little thing becomes a big thing. What are you going to talk about? How often can you talk about how great the Celtics are when they stubbed their toe in game two against Miami? Oh, what's going to happen now? Now the series is tied. What's going to happen? Well, they go and win in the last three games. When they lose game two to Cleveland. Oh, now what's going to happen? You know, the series is tied. We have to go to Cleveland. Well, you go to Cleveland and you win two there and you close it out. You know, that's just how it is. 6-0 on the road in the postseason so far. That's not big. Here's where the problem was. You could tell the way things were late in the season, in the regular season, when they lost back-to-back games against Atlanta, a team that barely was able to make the play-in. And one of those games, they blew a 31-point lead. Now you had to worry about, well, can they, you know, we started talking about, I did too, started talking about their inability to close games out in the fourth quarter, how they let teams back in. I mentioned to you guys how they play at the slowest pace in the fourth quarter of any team in the league. That's legit. It wasn't making it up. But we pick on these things, and they become major things because we don't have anything else. As you mentioned, 20 losses already in the regular season and playoffs combined. That's it. That's 76 times. You got to tell them how great they are. You got to find something, I guess, to nitpick, as it were. But they're dominating the league. They're dominating the postseason. And they're going to, like I mentioned, they're going to be prohibitive favorites in the finals against whichever team, most likely Dallas, that they come up with.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about what that might look like a little bit as we get a little bit further into our discussion here. But to me, you know, and we talked about this last week, the acquisition of Jrue Holiday prior to the season, some of our listeners know the story, not everybody does, but when Ross booked Giannis Antetokounmpo to come on this show in September, you know, we had a great discussion with him, and I remember asking him, do you see yourself playing the rest of your career in Milwaukee? And that's when he kind of, you know, said, well, you know, if everybody does what they're supposed to do as far as trying to keep the team intact, you know, it was sort of like kind of a yes, but. Well, it didn't take long after that for the wheels to be set in motion for the Bucks to acquire Damian Lillard. And as part of that whole, you know, maneuvering around their salary situation, they had to send Jrue Holiday out. He ended up in Portland as part of the package for Lillard. And I remember saying to you guys, I remember thinking immediately, Boston, I mean, that's the guy Boston needs to put them over the top, because they had already traded Marcus Smart away as part of the whole deal that got them Porzingis. Yep. So, but just Jrue Holiday, I mean, anybody who follows the NBA for any period of time understands he is like Mr. Intangible. He can do every little thing that matters on the court, many of which don't show up in the box score. And you saw that on display quite a bit in this series, as far as getting his hands on loose balls, good decision-making, patience, you know, being a calming influence on the team, making clutch plays. So, you know, some of us knew at the beginning that when we got that guy in Boston, it was going to be, you know, a huge difference. And along with Derek White, I mean, look, they're the two best defensive guards in the NBA. There were no guards on first-team all-defensive team. There were three on the second team, and those two were two of the three. So, you know, they're going to, you know, all year long, they've been a key to Boston, and their veteran leadership, defense, clutchness, really complimented Brown and Jason Tatum so well so far in the playoffs?
Well, I've mentioned to you guys throughout this whole season and into the playoffs that they were unique in being one of two teams that had a top five defense, offense, and a top five defense, the other being Oklahoma City. That was the key in this series. They really shut down Indiana, which had the second best offense coming into, you know, in the regular season, behind the second most efficient offense, as it turned out, in the history of the league, behind Boston. So Boston's defense was able to really put the clamps down, led by Drew Holiday, who basically secured game three with the steal of Nebhard's dribbling down in the lane there for trying to get one last shot there. And he got the big offensive rebound at the end of the game on Monday, game four, when they were trying to close it out. They missed a three-pointer. If Indiana gets it, they call timeout. They have a chance, one more chance to tie it, as they did in game three. But Drew Holiday grabs the offensive rebound. They run out the clock, and that's the series. Yo, he was a major key, just like you said. And you mentioned Derek White. 1-for-8 on threes until you need it most, and he drains a corner three to give him the lead, and you know, turned out to be the game-winning basket.
So Boston will be moving on to the NBA Finals, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the team that it looks like they're going to probably face in the finals, but that other team has a little bit more work to do. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Dallas Mavericks and the Minnesota Timberwolves in just a moment. All right, so welcome back. We're beginning our second half now. As previously discussed, Boston is now in the finals, and they're going to be looking to see who their next opponent will be. And World B, Tuesday night, Dallas has a chance to do to Minnesota what Boston did to Indiana, which is to say, sweep them. What have been your main takeaways from that series so far as we, you know, start – seeing the end of the road coming there soon, probably.
Yeah, my take on this series really isn't as hard as it is to believe when everything is written about Luka and Kyrie, and there's no question about their talent, how well they've played when it's counted most. But it's not so much what Dallas has done, it's what Minnesota has not done. Where's the defense? Where's that league-leading defense I've been bragging to you guys about all season? How much better their defense has been than anybody else in the league. I kept saying it over and over and over. And in this series, they're giving up 118.5 points per 100 possessions. I mean, it's just not even remotely close to what they did in the regular season when that number was about 110 per 100 possessions. They just, you know, and by the way, game three was their worst game of the playoffs. So when you need a big moment, when you need a big win, and your defense is your calling card, and you come up with your worst effort on defense. It's really, to me, this series is more about what Minnesota is not doing than what Dallas is doing. Think about this, Sal. Kyrie and Luka, they've been great. They've been clutch. We talk about, you know, we're looking forward to potentially a matchup between Dallas and Boston, all the storylines, how great that's going to be, star power personified. But in this series, they're only on when those two are on the court in 101 minutes, they're really only outscoring Minnesota by 10 points. So it's not like they're dominating the game when they're on the court together. Now, they match up well where they sit a lot. There's somebody always on the court for Dallas. One of the two is always on the court, which it makes perfect sense. But it's, you know, the clutch minutes, I mentioned that in the first series we talked about, it, with Boston and Indiana, in the clutch games, they're outscoring. They've only played 14 clutch minutes over three games. Dallas has won all three, obviously, and they're outscoring them 31-20 in those clutch minutes, and they're shooting 61% from the field. Minnesota in those clutch minutes are 35%. The games are there for Minnesota. They're just not able to get it done.
I think one of the, you know, I mean, look, coming into the series, you know, Anthony Edwards was pretty much the hottest thing going in the league. Yep. And he's had pretty good overall numbers against Dallas for the most part. He's averaging 22, 8, and 8, okay, not bad. He's only shooting, though, 38.6% from the floor, which is a lot worse than what he shot against Denver. He shot 50% from the floor against Denver, and he shot 51% against Phoenix. But Anthony Edwards is not the reason that Minnesota can't get over the hump in these games. In addition to the defense, as you properly pointed out, Karl-Anthony Towns has been abysmal in this series. Absolutely a terrible stretch. In his three games, he's shooting 27.7% from the floor. That's not on threes. That's 27.7% from the floor. He shot 51% against Denver, 53% against Phoenix, 50% for the regular season. But on threes, the self-proclaimed greatest shooting big man in the history of, you know, basketball planet, 13.6% on threes, 3 for 22, okay? He's averaging 15 points. He's rebounding. He's averaging eight rebounds plus. But I think Karl-Anthony Towns has laid a gigantic egg in this series.
No question. There's absolutely no question. You talk about, you look at this roster. Here's a defensive player of the year and Rudy Gobert that I'm supposed to get excited about. He's not even averaging eight rebounds, and he's averaging one block in this series. I mean, that's hardly impressive. You mentioned, you know, Karl-Anthony Towns, who's the self-proclaimed best big man perimeter shooter of all time, 3 of 22 from downtown in this series. That's not getting done. And you mentioned Anthony Edwards. You mentioned his numbers overall. His, you know, his regular stats are decent enough. 22 points per game, by the way. He's not getting it done in this series against a team like Dallas when you have Luka and Kyrie doing it. But it's other things. He's shooting under 40% from the field. He's shooting just 33% from three-point range. And over his last two games from 2 of 9 is – but here's another – here's a big thing. In the three games in the fourth quarter, he's taken 9 total shots. Now, this is the guy that's supposed to be the man. That's what I'm told. You know, social media and being what it is, all of a sudden the name MJ, Michael Jordan, is being connected with him because of how great Anthony Edwards is. And you know, there's nobody who's been a bigger fan of Anthony Edwards since his start than me, who won him on the All-Star team last year during our show. I championed that to no end. But the facts are the facts. He is not getting it done the way he's supposed to get it done. He is their main guy. He is their number one guy. This was his showcase series. It was supposed to be where I come and I average 28, 29, like Jaylen Brown does, like Jason Tatum does. This is my time to do it. And he just hasn't done it. The numbers are okay. You know, he's almost averaging a triple-double, whatever, but those are a little skewed when you look at his shooting numbers are off, and he's not getting it done in the big-time moments, that being the fourth quarter.
I mean, look, in the previous series against Denver, he averaged just under 28 a game, all right, 50% from the floor, you know. And against Phoenix, which was really, you know, that was a four-game sweep, he averaged 31, 8, and 6, shot 51% from the floor. So clearly, I mean, Dallas has been loading up on trying to stop him more. It always seems like whenever he gets the ball and he's ready to make a move, there's always like 1.5 guys on him. There's somebody guarding him and there's somebody shading him. And because Towns isn't knocking down any shots, they have gotten some decent offense from some of the lesser guys. I mean, McDaniels has played pretty well, and Kyle Anderson has played pretty well. Naz Reid has been like, you know, dope in the series. I mean, you know, especially from downtown. So really, you know, a little bit subpar from Edwards, a lot subpar from Towns, not a ton of help coming off of the bench there, spells, you know, 0-3. Now let's talk a little bit about the backcourt for Dallas, because really, you know, that as you know, wanting as Minnesota has found itself, Dallas has just been absolutely insane. Between Luka and Kyrie in the three games, okay, everybody's had 30 points or more except in one of those games when Kyrie had 20, okay? Luka had 33, 32, and 33. Kyrie, 33, 20, and 30. And here's the thing. I've not always been the biggest Luka fan, all right? And I've said it on this show many times. I always thought he was sort of a one-dimensional guy, you know, great offensive player, not a whole lot on defense. But I've watched him on defense in this series, and He is not locking anybody down. But what he is doing, he's moving his feet on defense, and he's putting himself in the proper position from a team defense standpoint to where he's in the right place at the right time. He's still rebounding, but occasionally he'll get his hand on a loose ball. But I just think his defensive attention to detail, I suppose, on defense has vastly been improved, World B.
Yeah, he's looked better at times. It's his offense is still his calling card, as we know, and that's what I've been most impressed with his play in the fourth quarter. He and Kyrie have just been cold blooded, especially Luka. I mean, his performance in game two, hitting the big three, was that game two or game three? I'm losing track here. Was that
the one in Gobert's face?
Yeah, that was game two.
Then he let him hear about it too.
And I commented to you guys about that was some cold ass blank right there by Luka, because that was it's really something else to watch him shoot, because he has been defended very well in this series by guys, and he doesn't have a lot of open looks. But he drains them right in his. It's not like Kyrie. Kyrie can get himself open a lot better than Luka can. And the two of them have really. It's assuming they don't become the first team to blow a 3-0 lead in the NBA history. This is shaping up to be really something special with Boston and Dallas. And like you said, and I've told you guys before, Dallas from about March on. From the beginning of March or beginning of February, I think it was the beginning of March, when they went on that really great run. They won 16 out of 18 before they gave up two at the end. They had a top five defense. That was the thing we were waiting on for them. We knew about their offense. We know Kyrie and Luka can get it going and can be 30 a night. Now they can be compared to the greatest duo of all time or the best backcourt of all time. Whatever, we can save that for another day. But the facts are the facts that offense was driving them, but now when they have defense now, and they have those guys, Lively, who I don't believe is going to play in game four because of that neck injury that he suffered, but Gafford's been solid, and PJ Washington has been solid, and Kyrie can play defense, Derek Jones Jr. can play these guys are really, really solid now all around, which is why they're in the conference finals, I guess, but they have been an impressive thing. Minnesota is not the greatest barometer for your team defense. Let's face it. You got to stop Anthony Edwards and hope Karl-Anthony Towns shoots like he does. But they're hardly a liability on offense. It is really impressive to see them the way they've been offensively and defensively in this series.
Well, you know, no matter how great your top two players are, okay, and this goes for Luka and Kyrie, it goes for Tatum and Brown, it goes for Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, for that matter, you have to have contributions from those other guys. And really, since PJ Washington came over from Charlotte, you know, before the trade deadline, he's been a huge difference maker for those guys. Certainly Derek Jones Jr., who's kind of a journeyman, kicked around for a lot of different teams for a lot of years, just a real, like, such a versatile defender who can run the floor. And, you know, if you give him an open shot, you know, he'll make it too. But those young bigs, I mean, Derek Lively, as you mentioned, who took the knee in the head from Towns in game three, and Daniel Gafford, those two guys have done a great job making themselves targets for alley-oops. They've gotten so many great alley-oop easy dunks again from Luka and from Kyrie. And those guys, their ability to kind of position themselves and make themselves big targets for those guys has taken a lot of the defensive pressure off of, or a lot of the pressure off of Kyrie and Luka, because they have like this automatic outlet now that they can, you know, throw it up there and one of those big young dudes will go up and get it. And I think against Boston, if this is how this works out, if Kristaps Porzingis is not able to play, or if he's not able to do his usual things, you're going to see a lot of alley-oop dunks against Boston coming from those guys, because, you know, the perimeter guys for Boston, we'll talk a little bit about that, you know, they're not going to make it easy for Luka and Kyrie to get buckets. But if they're able to get assists, they can do plenty of damage that way.
I think so as well. I think it, I personally think it's going to be a good series if it shapes up that way. I wonder about, as much as I think Dallas's defense has been impressive since the beginning of March, like I mentioned, they're going to be facing a much different animal in the Boston Celtics and their ability to score. I also think the guards, as we talked about for Boston, Drew Holiday and Derek White, will do a much better job preventing Kyrie and Luka from getting past the defender and setting up, having the defense collapse and thus setting up an alley-oop pass. Although watching Kyrie go against Boston will be worth the price of admission or worth tuning in for, because there's really, let's be honest, there's really nobody in the league that can put the clamps on a player like Kyrie Irving. It's really up to him how well he performs offensively. So it will be a really interesting matchup. The great thing about having Luka and Kyrie, they're arguably the two best closers in the league. And if you look at this season, they had the second best win percentage in games that had clutch minutes, 23-9. Only the Lakers were better. They were 24-9. So, you know, that's over 700 ball in games that are close. You have Kyrie, you have Luka, you have a chance. So far, they're 6-2 in the clutch games in the playoffs. I think they're tied with the now eliminated Knicks for clutch minutes, you know, games record in clutch minutes. So, you know, they having the two best closers, if you can keep it within striking distance, and Boston doesn't always have it in the fourth quarter this season. They showed it in this series they did, certainly did. But it'll be a very interesting matchup to see if they can stop Luka and Kyrie if the games are tight come fourth quarter.
Well, that's what everybody's wondering. Can Boston slow those two guys down, you know, let alone stop them? But here's the thing. What can Dallas do with Brown and Tatum? I mean, both of those guys averaged big numbers against Dallas this season. I think Tatum was around 30 and Brown was in the high 20s. Don't quote me on that. I saw the numbers, but I don't remember them precisely. But, you know, it's really going to be kind of a clash of styles, you know, this two-headed monster backcourt against this two-headed monster front court for Boston. Again, with Porzingis, if he comes back, I think, you know, Boston will definitely win the series. If he doesn't come back, I think Boston still will probably win the series. But I think we're going to see him at some point. But I have a question for you. And again, I know that I'm kind of throwing this one at you out of nowhere, but because you're so good with the analytics, I'm thinking you might be able to bail me out with a decent answer here. If you're Boston and you're trying to figure out how to stop Kyrie and Luka, is it better for them both to have, say, 30 points in the game, or would it be better to totally load up on one of those guys and make their life almost impossible, and even if the other one goes off for 50? So if they normally combine for 60, okay, 30 and 30, let's say they decide they're going to load up on Kyrie. They're going to stop Kyrie at all costs and hold him to, say, 14 points, okay? And then Luka gets like 48. Is that better or worse for Boston, or doesn't really make a difference?
I don't know if it makes a big difference. I think one of the things you're trying hinting at is, we'll let Kyrie and or Luka get theirs. Let's just stop everybody else. Where else are they going to get the scoring? And that's a legit question there, because as you just mentioned. This series for Dallas, or this postseason for Dallas, really turned in their favor the way P.J. Washington is playing, the way he's gotten shots and made shots, and Derek Jones Jr. has gotten shots and made shots. Now, can they do it in the final series against a defense like Boston, which can defend with the best of them in the league? That's going to be a big question. I don't know if you can – I won't say you – it's impossible to stop either one of them, because as I mentioned before, Dallas in this series, in this Western Conference Finals, has had a Luka and Kyrie on the court for 101 minutes. They've only outscored Minnesota by 10 points over the time. That's 3 points a game. That's not a dramatic you know, not a blowout sort of thing. They've been able to do it in the fourth quarter. They've been able to do it when one's been on the court and the other hasn't. I think letting those guys get there, I don't think you're going to let them get there. I don't, their points. I don't think it's the worst thing that can happen for Boston if they do, given the ability for the others to score. I don't think it makes a difference. And, you know, long answer is short there. I don't think it makes that much of a difference. To me, the series from Dallas's perspective, can BJ Washington make those shots like he did before? Can Derrick Jones Jr. be athletic enough to get those shots? He's really probably the best athlete on the floor between all three of them, maybe Tatum, but he jumps a lot higher and can just sky above everybody else for rebounds. So he'll have that advantage, I think. And for me, you mentioned if Porzingis plays, this series is heavily in Boston's favor. I don't disagree with that. The depth of Boston becomes an issue if he, for some reason, isn't able to play or isn't effective when he plays and has to sit time. But Al Horford's been great for Boston, but Al Horford's going to be entering game number 100 or whatever we're at now for Boston. And so, late 30s, that catches up with you. He played 40 minutes tonight, and he gets a nice rest now, for a while, but they really need another big coming off the bench. They're not really – it doesn't seem like they're totally confident with Xavier Tillman right now. They've given him more minutes, but only – not even 10 minutes a night. They're just – they need somebody to give Al Horford a rest. And when Tillman and Al Horford have been off the court, it's defensively has not been great for Boston. So let's – I'd like to see everybody full strength. Personally, I wanted to see everybody at full strength in this postseason. So hopefully Porzingis can come back and we can have a really fun series.
I think Joe Mazzulla has done – you mentioned him a little bit earlier in our conversation here. I think he's done a very good job managing Horford's minutes. And again, Tillman wasn't really hardly playing at all. But in the last three games, he's gotten in there playing, anywhere between like 9 and 13 minutes. And I think particularly in game three where Tillman played, I think, 13 minutes and Horford played 35, you could see how much fresher Horford's legs were down the stretch. He was grinding on defense even harder than early in the game, and he was making threes late in the game. So, I don't think Mazzulla got any credit for that, but I believe that was a solid move by Mazzulla. Now, here's a question that I'm wondering about, and again, we'll see. We know that Jaylen Brown is capable of guarding, forwards, guards, whatever. I'm wondering, Luka is like the guy that's got to be stopped. I mean, he's the big cheese there. I'm wondering, are we going to see Jaylen Brown on him for any periods of time during the game? Obviously, Holiday and White can hold their own against him, but Luka's a powerful physical force. And I think, it would be nice if whoever's got him could get a little breather once in a while and you throw Jaylen Brown on him, who's, just as tall as he is. I'll be curious to see if that's a Joe Mazzulla move.
It's a fair question. I think the issues you run into, I don't know if it's, yeah, I guess it's potential issues, is do you risk Jaylen Brown or Luka, excuse me, has a remarkable habit of creating fouls for the opponent, drawing fouls. He gets to the line a lot. He knows how to do the flopping better than anybody in the league. That's just how it is. We all know it. And do you risk letting somebody like Jaylen Brown, who will probably try and be physical, allow Jaylen Brown to pick up two fouls in the first quarter because you're guarding, or pick up that needless third foul when you decide to go on him, number one. Number two, Luka's a hard guy to guard for Boston. He's a hard guy to guard. He knows how to get his points. He's a big guy. Do you risk sacrificing some of his offense, Jaylen Brown, I'm saying, in order to try and lock down Luka here? It's a fair question. I don't know if it's going to, the situation tonight. If you assume Jrue Holiday will be on Kyrie and you know, the question will be who guards Luka here. It's a fair question. I wouldn't be surprised to see him on it, but there is risk involved.
Well, he can't guard him the entire game. That isn't even what I'm suggesting. I'm just looking for in stretches. All right, so it's likely that the finals are not going to begin until June 6th. I don't know that they can move the dates up because of a number of reasons. So if Dallas should wrap things up on Tuesday night, we're looking at like 11 days before the finals begins. I guess that's probably to everyone's benefit and to everyone's disadvantage as well, because they're all coming off playing their best ball. And now that's going to be like, boom, you know, let's take a pause for like a week and a half. So
it's the Super Bowl.
Right. So I don't know if we even want to start making predictions at this point. You know, we're going to do another show at least before that series begins. So we don't have to make any formal predictions here. But, you know, I'm expecting Dallas to finish Minnesota off on Tuesday night. What are you thinking? Mini will get one?
I think Minnesota gets one. I think they'll get one. No reason to feel that way. They're playing in Dallas. That crowd will be fired up to get a sweep and everything, and Dallas is probably looking at what happened on Monday going, all right, let's get our rest too. Why give Dallas why give Boston all the fun of resting? I'll tell you this. I want to see Dallas play that complete game. Their first three quarters haven't been always the best. They've absolutely done the job in the fourth quarter, and it's gotten them to a 3-0 lead. Let's see Dallas play complete game for three quarters, first three quarters there. And let's see, you know, you say it's impossible, but you know, just 1 year ago, Boston down 3-0 to Miami, almost pulled it off, won three in a row and ran out of gas in game seven. So I don't suspect this will go seven, but I'm going to say Minnesota will get a game. Why not?
All right, so you're saying that Karl Anthony Towns is going to make a couple threes on
at
Tuesday
least one.
Night and extend the series. All right, we're going to take go ahead.
No, I'm saying Anthony Edwards will, I think he'll get to 30. Anthony Edwards will score 30.
All right, you heard it here, folks. We're going to talk for a moment after a quick break about some of the coaching news around the league, so stand by. All right, and welcome back. J.B. Bickerstaff, World B. Freer, was dismissed as Cavaliers head coach 1 week after the Cavs playoff run, the team's deepest since 2018 and longest without LeBron James on the roster since 1993. Cleveland played the final two games of that series without Donovan Mitchell. They played the whole series without Jared Allen. He won 99 games the last 2 years. World B, was this just bogus that he lost his job?
Absolutely. I mean, no question at all that this was a silly decision to fire. I don't know the reason behind. You hear rumblings that some players weren't exactly thrilled with JB or whatever, with his coaching decisions or whatever it may be. I think that's garbage. I look at situations like this and I look at where was this franchise before he got there? And this franchise, before he took over for John Beilein, I'm a Mountaineer. John Beilein was a disaster as an NBA coach in Cleveland. That was a terrible decision made by the front office of Cleveland, by the way. So they bring Bickerstaff on as an interim. He goes 5-6, I believe, down the stretch. And then they get better every year under him. They didn't have as many wins as last season, but they got one round further than a season ago. And I don't really – it was a lame move. It was a lame move. I look at where they were before he got there, and you have to go back three straight winning seasons under Bickerstaff. You know the last time they did that under – and Cleveland without LeBron James on the roster, you have to go back to the late 90s when Mike Fratello was there. That's how bad it was in Cleveland. That's how bad it's going to be if they make ridiculous decisions like this. And I don't know who you're going to necessarily bring in that's suddenly going to transform. Who's out there that's going to make this team suddenly, you know, a major contender in the East? They didn't have Jared Allen. They lost Donovan Mitchell for the last two games. You're going up against the most dominant team in the league in Boston. what exactly were your expectations for this season after, you know, after you won a first round series? And, you know, let's be honest, they did not look great in that series against Orlando. They had to go seven games. They were down 18 in game seven, came back and won that. I know that as a Magic fan, I can recite that easily without looking at my notes. So I don't know where Cleveland thinks what their expectations are. They don't have cap space. They're not, they got to keep their guys. You know, they got to keep, figure out a way if Mitchell wants to be there. And then if he doesn't, what do? Do you blow this team up? It's just to go where they've been to where they potentially could be in a year is because of this coaching decision is silly.
Mitchell can sign a four-year, $200 million contract extension with the Cavs this summer. So my guess is that management wants to show him that they'll make big moves to try and improve the team. Now, I'm not saying for a second that Mitchell had anything to do with him being fired. I don't want to suggest that at all because I have no information that that's the case. But it's hard to imagine Bickerstaff could have done much more than he did with the situation he found himself in. So I think management was probably trying to make almost a preemptive strike here and say, Donovan, look it, you know, we're going to go out there and we're going to, you're going to get, we want you to stay here and we want to, you know, I'm sure he's going to have all kinds of input on who the next coach will be. So even if he wasn't responsible for Bickerstaff being gone, I think you can be pretty certain that, in their effort to keep him, he will be consulted on the next coach. Finally, other head coaching vacancies are with the Lakers, where ESPN's J.J. Redick has been mentioned as a possible replacement for Darvin Ham. And the Wizards' job is open in Washington. Anybody who wants it can probably pretty much have it. That's got to be an awful job. And Phoenix fired Frank Vogel after being swept by Minnesota. They've already filled their job with Mike Budenholzer. So, World B, here's my theory. If J.J. Redick gets the Lakers job, okay, he will be the second ESPN announcer to leave their A booth to take a coaching job after Doc Rivers left earlier in the season to take the Milwaukee job. So to me, at that point, the logical replacement for J.B. Bickerstaff will probably be Doris Burke because she's the last analyst at ESPN standing that hasn't been offered a head coaching job this year. What do you think?
If you're crazy enough to go ahead and fire a successful coach like J.B. Bickerstaff, then you're crazy enough to go ahead and hire somebody else from ESPN with absolutely zero coaching experience to run the sidelines for you. Yes, I can. It would actually clear up create an opportunity for our guy Tim Legler, who I think should be on the call for. For their be part of the number one crew, they want to actually turn things around. The Laker job, I don't know why anybody would want it at this point. Doesn't pay very well, apparently, and the Lakers are not anywhere close to being a contender in the West, in my opinion. And the Wizards, I think they're going to keep. It sounds like they're going to keep Ryan Keefe, the interim coach, around. Another strange fire and dismissal of Wes Unseld Jr. I mean, what are you trying to do? You know, midseason, what are you trying to do? If you're Washington, there's nothing going on there. And so Brian Keefe, that's a tough way to learn on the job by being saddled with a team that is trying to rebuild but has no cap space because they're overspent on – they took on so much ridiculous salary.
Jordan Poole
and Kyle Kuzma. I mean, why didn't you get rid of them at the trade deadline?
We've spent enough time talking about that dumpster fire in Washington, World B. Listen, I know,
that was 30 seconds longer than it should have been.
And we only spent 30 seconds on it. It was still exactly. 30 seconds too long. Anyway, before we say goodbye for this edition of the show, any final thoughts either on Boston, Dallas, Minnesota, Indiana, Bill Walton, anything you want to say before we say goodbye?
I'm looking forward to a Dallas Boston NBA Finals, star power personified.
And that's going to be an exciting series. We'll see if Dallas can close the deal on Tuesday night. That is going to do it for this edition of the 48 Minutes Podcast presented by Bet Online. For World Be Freer, I'm Bruce Bernstein and Ross Geiger, who's not with us this week. He should be back next week. We'll see you all next week. Have a good one, everyone.